this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And starting on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the headline across the top of the page, Data Show Local Banks Still Not Lending. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. Community bank lending in the Triangle fell by nearly 11% in 2010, with land clearing and construction loans taking the biggest hit, new data show. Net loans written by 13 local banks totaled $5.92 billion during the calendar year, down from $6.62 billion in 2009. The banks reported the information to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which says bank loans shrank nationwide during nine of the past 10 quarters. Southeastern banking analyst Don Coker says the numbers are a sign that a hunkering down mentality continues to prevail throughout the industry. They're still afraid if they put money out there, it will come back as a mistake, says Coker, who admits to being impatient with the banking industry. Argument that demand for loans is low. I'm not saying that it's a tremendous demand, but there is demand, he says. Of the 13 local banks, 10 showed loan declines ranging from 2.5% to 14%. The 2.5% drop was at Raleigh's Trust Atlantic Bank. CEO Jim Beck says he had hoped for modest growth in 2010, even as he sought to be more strict on loans for non-owner-occupied land development and construction, which are generally more speculative than other types of bank lending. Instead of growth, we ended with a small decline, says Beck, but I am not unhappy with where we are. We'd like to get the growth moving ahead this year. Generally, a large percentage of local land development and construction lending goes toward home building. Beck and his lieutenants ended up cutting such loans by nearly 15% to $95 million last year. At the 10 community banks during 2010, land development and construction lending dropped by 29% from $1.8 billion in 2009 to $1.3 billion. Since many of these banks lend in the local community, that's a $500 million less in circulation for a hard-hit industry. Beck, for one, says his shift away from more speculative real estate deals will continue in 2011, with Trust Atlantic putting more emphasis on owner-occupied building loans and commercial and industrial business loans. Grant Yarber, now market president for North Carolina of Raleigh-based Capital Bank, is optimistic about a lending expansion in 2011. We will be working to get money out the door as fast as we can, says Yarber, who adds that Capital's sale for $181 million to a Charlotte investment group has left the bank with a burgeoning war chest. Not all community banks chalked up smaller lending volumes in 2010. Net loans actually grew at three banks, which proved the exception to the rule. They were Raleigh-based North State, which grew its loan book by 5% to $541 million. Capstone Bank, also of Raleigh, where lending grew by 3% to $133 million, and Durham-based KeySource, another business lender, up 9% to $169 million. We have been lending as much as we can, says Capstone CEO Steve Ogburn, but there hasn't been a whole lot going on out there. Commercial real estate lending holding up better last year than other loan types advanced by 5% at the Triangle's largest community banks last year. At the regional bank level, the 2010 results for Raleigh-based institutions were mixed. Total net loans advanced by nearly 6% at First Citizens to $11 billion. At RBC Bank USA, they fell by 6.2% to $17.9 billion. And as we move down the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, there's an article, it's in the center of the page, has a black border around it. Inside that border, first the top half is a picture, looks like of people standing in line at RDU Airport at the ticket counters. And it has a little graph in the corner with the headline, Disappearing Seats. And it's a listing, year-by-year listing of the capacity at RDU. Now, below all of that, there's first on the left side, the headline in bold black lettering, Fuel costs to spur fewer seats. Carriers can save by cutting capacity, number of flights. And then on the right side is where the article actually begins. And this is written by Chris Basden with the Dateline of Morrisville. Business travelers soon could find themselves paying more for less at Raleigh-Durham International Airport, thanks to higher fuel prices. Escalating oil prices already have prompted airlines to try to impose 5 broad-based fare increases this year, with varying degrees of success. If oil prices remain elevated, expect the other shoe eventually to drop, in the form of capacity cuts or fewer available seats. That would reduce passengers' flight options at RDU. If business travelers start to resist fare hikers, then you will see more aggressive capacity cuts, says aviation analyst Bob Mann. There is historical precedent. Back in the winter of 2008, oil prices approached $100 a barrel, just as they are now. In February of that year, oil broke the $100 barrier mark, eventually climbing to just north of $145 in early July. With the economic downturn pummeling demand, carriers countered with dramatic capacity cuts, eliminating flights and even some routes. The idea was both to group inefficient aircraft and restrict the supply of seats in a way that would increase demand and allow carriers to raise fares. How severe were the cuts? The number of available seats at RDU in the third quarter of 2007 clocked in at 1.83 million, according to data provided by aviation consulting firm OAG. A year later, that figure had declined by 8.7% to 1.67 million seats. Carriers slashed another 7.8% by the third quarter of 2009, when there were just 1.54 million available seats. After starting to lose capacity in the second quarter of 2008, RDU didn't begin to add capacity again on a year-over-year basis until the fourth quarter of 2010. Those cuts resulted in higher costs and fewer options for travelers. Frequent flyer Michael Lott, the president of Raleigh-based product and graphic design firm Lott Design, says having fewer flights makes it tougher on business travelers. Fewer frequencies may cause a business traveler to have to spend an extra night on a business trip. That adds to the trip's expense in terms of a hotel stay and additional meals on the road, as well as in time lost in the office. If I'm not here, there are a lot of things that don't happen on their own, says Lott. How likely is a repeat of 2008? The situation for airlines has changed over the past 3 years. During that time, the country has emerged from the Great Recession, and all the capacity cuts have given carriers pricing power that they didn't previously enjoy. Combined with cutting capacity and costs while also enhancing revenue by implementing fees, including baggage fees, airlines experienced a stellar year revenue-wise in 2010, with the International Airport Air Transport Association reporting a record industry profit of $16 billion. With the political unrest in the Middle East causing oil prices to flare up, more capacity cuts could be on the way, even if they're not as severe as before. One of the likely casualties could be 50-seat aircraft, which aren't nearly as economical as bigger planes, especially with oil near $100 a barrel. Routes with 50-seat planes have been vulnerable for several years, says Mike Miller, the vice president of strategy for the American Aviation Institute. There will be among the first to go. Although there's no crystal ball revealing which flights might be cut, several carriers use 50-seat aircraft, including Air Canada, which operates a 50-seater to Toronto, Delta Connection to Boston, U.S. Air Express to Boston, Washington National and LaGuardia, and American Eagle to Washington National, JFK, and LaGuardia. More capacity cuts could be bad news for the budget of the RDU Airport Authority, which relies on passengers for much of its revenue. More people flying translates into more car rentals, concessions, and parking revenue. We know that things can change quickly, says RDU spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin. We budget conservatively to anticipate any possible changes in the aviation industry. And now if we move just to the right of that story, still on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the headline on this article, Custer's March Makes Strides. And the article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. And the article runs vertically along the right side of the page. And at the bottom of the article, just under it, there's a picture of a man sitting with his hands folded, wearing a suit. The caption reads, Scott Custer says he's working to build a company with value. In just 13 months, Raleigh banker Scott Custer has cobbled together a statewide $1.2 billion bank holding company with 19 offices stretching from Salisbury near Charlotte to the port city of Wilmington. That makes Piedmont Community Bank Holdings the 17th largest bank in North Carolina in terms of total assets, according to the most recent market share data. The latest move by Custer, the former CEO of Raleigh's RBC Bank USA, and his Chapel Hill-based private equity backers was the February 23rd announcement that they'll be taking a majority stake in Cary-based Crescent State Bank with a $75 million cash infusion. It won't be the last. We intend to be as opportunistic as we can be, says Custer. While not providing specific guidance on where he and his partners are looking next, he did say he's scouting potential deals in both Carolinas and Virginia, and that he hasn't set a ceiling on the potential size of the bank holding company being created. Meanwhile, Piedmont Community Bank Holdings has expanded its office space at Raleigh's North Hills and is in the process of adding staff. To date, the only finalized deal in the Piedmont portfolio is the 2009 takeover of Burlington-based two-office, $82 million total asset Vantage South Bank. The two deals, still awaiting approval of state and federal regulators, are the acquisition of Salisbury-based Bank of Rowan, also a two-office operation, but with $140 million in total assets, and the Crescent deal, which would bring 15 offices and total assets of $974 million. In Burlington, Custer aggressively has moved to work through Vantage South's problem loans in a push to regain profitability. Loans no longer repaying were slashed by 93% at the bank during calendar year 2010. Custer says the same model will be put in place at Crescent, which, while cutting its overall losses in 2010, also saw non-paying, mostly real estate loans, increase by 69% to $30.5 million, according to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. It's a bank with issues to work through, says Chris Marinac, who covers Crescent for Fig Partners, but its marriage with Piedmont was not of the shotgun variety. If it had been like that, they wouldn't have gotten $4.75 a share, he says. They, Piedmont, saw fundamental value in the stock, which was undervalued, and they got that value realized. Piedmont's $75 million deal for newly issued and existing shares of the bank came in at 78% of Crescent's book value. North American Financial Holdings, a Charlotte private equity group that acquired Raleigh's Capital Bank, by contrast, paid 44% of book value. Paul Mirsky, economist with the Washington, D.C.-based Independent Community Bankers of America, says so few mergers have taken place in recent months that it's hard to pinpoint where mergers are falling on the book value scale. He does expect the number of mergers to increase, however. Absolutely, and I think the FDIC has said they expect to see that too, says Mirsky. Down the road, according to the Piedmont model, the banks rolled into the holding company will share a number of back-office operations, thereby cutting expenses. Custer says it's too early to put a number on what those savings might be. Custer was brought into Piedmont by Chapel Hill businessman Adam Abram and his partner Stephen J. Lerner. Abram created and later sold a property and casualty insurance company, James River, with the financial backing of two New York-based private equity firms, Stone Point Capital, with more than $10 billion under management, and Lightyear Capital, with $3 billion. Both have made commitments to Piedmont. It's in the nature of private equity investors to seek an exit. Marinac puts that exit window at 5 to 7 years in the case of Piedmont. Custer, however, says he has not discussed an exit horizon with his partners. I'm trying to build a company that has lasting value, he says. And our last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal runs horizontally across the bottom of the page. The headline, In the End, Weddle's employment contract played role in departure. And then first on the far left, there's a picture of a man standing outside of a building, casually dressed. The caption reads, Rick Weddle can claim several successful years running the technology park. And then next to that is the article, and it's written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the dateline of Research Triangle Park. Rick Weddle's sudden and surprising departure as president and CEO of the Research Triangle Foundation to take a less prominent job in Florida may have been about money and retirement. Well compensated during his years as leader of the foundation that manages and markets Research Triangle Park, Weddle, 59, wanted assurance that he could stay on past the retirement age written into his contract, says several sources with knowledge of the departure. Sources say Weddle and many on the RTF board disagreed on the point after researching contracts of other economic development jobs across the country. When it was discovered that Weddle was putting out feelers for a new job, he was told by a frustrated board to make a search quick. The frustration came in large part because the board had been generous with Weddle, who collected a base salary of $292,469 in 2010, plus a bonus of $44,000 in December. In Orlando, his starting salary will be $300,000 a year, plus benefits and additional incentives, according to Maureen Brockman with the Metro Orlando Economic Development Commission. I've read through the contract, and I don't see anything in the contract that would cap when he would have to retire, Brockman says. Repeated calls to Weddle went unanswered. Rick looked around, found another job, and was ready to go, says David Ward Jr., chairman of the RTF board. It's not clear what direction the board will take to fill Weddle's position or whether the job will be filled in its current form. With a new master plan for the park in the works, some speculate that the foundation could better be served, for example, by a couple of corporate recruiters to sell the park and an administrator to run the offices. Ward acknowledges that the new master plan could redefine the foundation president's job description. We don't have to rush into anything, Ward says. We've got our challenges and our opportunities, and we'll address them as they come. Ward, 75, has served as chairman of the foundation's 18-member board for the past 10 years and says he has no immediate plans to step down. I'm still chairman and will be chairman until I'm not chairman, he says. Ward and RTF Master Plan Committee head Richard Doherty were scheduled to have exited the board in December 2010, but with the master plan starting at the finish line and staring at the finish line and upcoming changes at the leadership spot, the RTF board is expected to pass a resolution keeping Ward and Doherty through the end of 2011. In the interim, Executive Vice President Liz Rooks, who has been with the foundation since the late 1980s, is serving as interim president, and CEO Rooks, who will oversee the foundation's staff of 17, says she doesn't expect to be considered to succeed Weddle on a permanent basis. The board and Weddle in the fall set in motion plans to craft a new master plan that would set down guidelines for the future development of land and infrastructure within the park. The master plan report is slated to be complete in July. Weddle was a major proponent of the plan. That's another reason his announcement February 22nd was, or that he was taking a job as the top executive of the Metro Orlando Economic Development Commission, befuddled many in the Triangle business community. In the 2009 fiscal year, the RTF had more than $83.7 million in assets, which compared to $75.7 million in assets the year before. Much of the increase was attributed to improved investment returns. The foundation serves as the developer and manager of the park's 7,000 acres straddling Durham and Wake counties, of which only about 500 acres remain unsold. The park is home to major operations for companies including IBM, GlaxoSmithKline, Fidelity Investments, and Cisco Systems. Jeff Finkel, president and CEO of the International Economic Development Council in Washington, D.C., says he has known both Weddle and Weddle's predecessor at RTP, Jim Roberson, for many years. When each got their respective jobs, it was no surprise, Finkel says. Both were quality professionals at the top of their game. It will be interesting as someone in this field to see who the foundation anoints next and who they consider to be tops in the game. Roberson says there were some very strong voices among his board members that the foundation needed younger people among its leadership. I know they had a lot of concern about what the retirement age ought to be, he says. Roberson still collects about $100,000 in pay from the foundation each year as part of a non-compete agreement he signed upon his retirement. Prior to that, he says he had no contract with the board. Maybe they offered him, Weddle, something in Orlando they couldn't give him here. Susie Jernigan, a managing director with the Sockwell Partners executive search firm in Charlotte, says finding a strong candidate to lead the foundation won't be hard. Research Triangle Park is the granddaddy of research parks, and this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, she says. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, State Lottery falls short on revenue but beats revision. The North Carolina Education Lottery isn't feeling so lucky these days when it comes to revenue. The lottery generated $918.8 million in sales during the first 8 months of the current fiscal year. That's 2% behind the $938.2 million the games notched in the same period last year. The lottery had projected that its sales for the first 8 months of this fiscal year would total $963.4 million. After the year got off to a poor start, the lottery revised that projection downward to $876.5 million. In the spirit of those fiscal maneuvers, Biz would like to revise some Powerball lottery ticket numbers from a few weeks back. Quack, quack, score one for the Ducks. Ducks Unlimited of North Carolina has raised a whopping $27 million, granted it took 7 years, but still, to help fulfill the organization's mission of preserving waterfowl and wetlands in our grand state. 7 years ago, we embarked on a journey to raise $27 million to conserve 70,000 acres in North Carolina and on the breeding grounds important to our state, says Lloyd Good of Raleigh, past North Carolina Ducks Unlimited state chairman and current DU regional vice president. The Sound Care Initiative was the first of its kind for Ducks Unlimited, a comprehensive state campaign that included all sources of revenue raised in the state for waterfowl and wetlands conservation. Completion of the campaign will be celebrated with a party on March 4 at the pavilions at the Angus Barn. The Triangle is getting its third The Meat House store, this one in Chapel Hill. Paul Kuhn and Donna Kuhn have the franchise rights for the store that will be at 1508 East Franklin Street. The Meat House in Cary and one to open in early April in Raleigh are owned by the father-son team of Craig Wilkins and Derek Wilkins. The Kuhns spent more than 30 years working for manufacturing and sales companies that moved them all over the country, including 12 years in North Carolina. The couple discovered the Meat House while living in New Hampshire, its home base, and became fans. We are thrilled and proud to be a part of such a great brand, says Paul Kuhn. MindWorks Multimedia, an interactive multimedia and video production company in Durham, has earned Green Plus certification from the Institute for Sustainable Development in Chapel Hill. Green Plus is a triple bottom line sustainability certificate program. Folks from the much-heralded UNC Chapel Hill and Duke University MBA programs were squished in a competition in which case studies were presented, and teams from the schools had to develop valuation, capital markets, and M&A strategic advice for a panel of seasoned M&A professionals. The Wake Forest University Babcock Graduate School of Business took top honors at the competition, hosted by the Association for Corporate Growth, Raleigh-Durham chapter. The North Carolina State University Jenkins MBA program secured second, and the Duke University Fuqua School of Business was third. The Meredith College School of Business and UNC Chapel Hill Keenan Flagler School of Business rounded up the field. Everyone wants something for free, right? Well, whip out your Bank of America, Merrill Lynch debit or credit card and pay a visit to Durham's Nasher Museum of Art or Raleigh's Marbles Kids Museum and get in for free. The museums are taking part in Bank of America's National Museums on Us program. With your card in hand and a valid photo ID, you will gain one free general admission to either of the museums. The offer is good for the first full weekend of each month through December 4. Eye Contact employees have been busy giving back. In 2010, employees at the email marketing company in Morrisville completed more than 1,850 hours of volunteer work. The company contributed to more than 150 nonprofit organizations and provided its products to more than 200 organizations on a pro bono basis. Eye Contact rolled out its corporate social responsibility program in 2010 for the company and its employees to give back in four ways. Some of the profit organizations benefiting from the program in the past year: Family Violence Prevention of Chapel Hill, Dress for Success of Durham, and Raleigh JC's in Raleigh. With all the machinations involving those working in anything that's printed on paper, it's not a big surprise that the UNC Printing Services is laying off 9 of its 21 employees and closing copy centers in the Student Union and the Kenan Flagler Business School. The printing service has lost a total of $2.1 million over the past decade, and university officials say they're working to get the operation to a break-even point. If you buy a Jersey Mike sub in the Raleigh-Durham area this month, you'll help provide relief to victims of disaster. Through the end of March, the American Red Cross is joining forces with Jersey Mike's restaurants throughout the Triangle for a month of giving fundraising campaign to provide relief to victims of disaster and help people prevent, prepare for, and respond to emergencies. Customers can make donations to the American Red Cross at any Jersey Mike's store in Raleigh and Durham. Customers who make a $5 donation to the American Red Cross will receive 6 specially branded Jersey Mike's Silly Bands and a coupon for free chips and a drink. ITT Technical Institute, a for-profit college, will open a campus in Durham in April, according to a National Commercial Real Estate Report. A report by CoStar identifies the educational program as the new anchor tenant in the South Park Office Center in Durham, leasing 19,709 square feet. Local agents would not comment. A representative of ITT's parent company, ITT Educational Services Incorporated of Carmel, Indiana, did not return calls. Clyde J. Christmas, executive chef at Hope Valley Country Club in Durham, is one of 3 chefs to be awarded the American Culinary Federation's Cutting Edge Award at the 2011 AFC Southeast Regional Conference at the Hilton Atlanta on February 21. The Cutting Edge Award recognizes industry leaders, ACF chapters, and supporting agencies for their leadership and service to the culinary profession. Other winners were a chef in Sunrise, Florida, and a chef in Prospect, Kentucky. For the 3rd year in a row, GlaxoSmithKline and the Triangle Community Foundation will award $40,000 each to up to 10 groups that set an outstanding example in providing access to health care. The GlaxoSmithKline Impact Awards will honor community nonprofit organizations in Alamance, Chatham, Durham, Franklin, Harnett, Johnston, Lee, Moore, Orange, Person, and Wake counties. Applications will be accepted through 4 p.m. on March 31. For information, visit the GSK or Triangle Community Foundation websites. Contributing to Biz were staffers Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Chris Baisden, Monica Chen, Dathan Kuzak, and Jason DeBruin. And now we return to the full-length stories in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to, the headline, County Cuts Severe, $700 million and Counting. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. And on the article runs horizontally across the very top of the page. On the far left, there's a picture of a man sitting in an office, tie on, looking at some papers on his desk. The caption reads, Way County Manager David Cook awaits cuts. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. Back of the envelope calculations show state appropriations to North Carolina's 100 counties being cut by roughly $700 million over the next 2 years, a figure that's put county officials on high alert. Many of the reductions take aim at schools, forcing county administrators to decide whether to make up the gaps or let them pass. Way County Manager David Cook was unambiguous when asked for his reaction. If the assumption is the county will replace the money that's being lost, well, it's a bad assumption. The Raleigh-based North Carolina Association of County Commissioners has been busy over the past 2 weeks totaling up the hits that counties will take, given the budget cutting that's going on in the General Assembly. The group characterizes the re-entrenchment as a major shift away from the past. The counties are concerned, says NCACC's Todd McGee, and many people think these actions will be opening the way for local property tax increases. Among the dollars lost, according to the group's list, would be $60 million from the state for school bus replacement, $35 million that went to pay workers' compensation premiums of some school employees, $72 million in corporate income tax collections funneled to the counties to help pay for school construction, $115 million during each of the next 2 years by reducing the county's share of lottery proceeds. Add the proposed cuts to previous state reductions, says McGee, and you have $1 billion that we lost over the past 4 years. For Cook, perhaps the most nettlesome of the proposed cuts would be the lottery reduction. Wake uses the cash, $10 million last year, to pay down a portion of its debt, including school construction bonds. He's not sure yet how much of the $10 million Wake would lose, but whatever the amount would hurt. The debt is something that you have to pay, Cook says. It's early to comment on this because it's got to go through the legislature's hands, but if the reductions take place, we'd have to cut other stuff. Wake's fiscal 2010 to 2011 spending was $951 million, down 2% from the prior year, with 50.2% of it going for school expenses. Orange County, which spent a total of $175 million in 2010 through 2011, down 1.3% from the prior year, doesn't use lottery proceeds to make debt service payments. Rather, the money goes for capital projects, including new school buildings. It's a choice that's brought the county additional flexibility, since building projects can be trimmed or delayed while debt service payments can't, says County Manager Frank Clifton. As to what the county could be facing as it prepares its new budget this spring, Clifton says he'll wait for better numbers from Raleigh. I'm not a Chicken Little person, he says. I'll wait for the meat. Our next article is on the same page. It's in the center of the page. Has a black border around it. Inside that border at the top, there's a picture of two men standing next to each other and both looking at the cameras, smiling and shaking hands, wearing suits. The caption reads, Samsung Senior Vice President Christopher Ko and Quintiles Senior Vice President Anand Thamaratnam shake on the arrangement. And then under that, there's the headline in bold black letters, What the JV Means, Win-Win Scene in Quintiles Samsung Deal. And this article is written by Monica Chen with a Dateline of Durham. Quintiles Transnational's joint venture with electronics giant Samsung has the double-barreled mission of boosting the Durham company's clinical and consulting businesses in Asia while developing the Korean company while helping the Korean company get its foot in the door of the drug development business. Quintiles is contributing 10% or $30 million to the joint venture. Samsung is chipping in the remaining $270 million. To start, the Samsung Quintiles joint venture will construct a biopharmaceutical manufacturing plant in the Incheon Free Economic Zone in South Korea. Quintiles has about 100 employees in South Korea and will not be hiring more personnel for the JV. Nonetheless, over time, the company will lend its consulting and clinical knowledge to help Samsung start its biopharmaceutical business, which aims to manufacture biosimilars, or products that have properties similar to existing drugs and treatments marketed after the expiration of patents. Quintiles officials say the partnership does have an established length of time, but declined to comment on further details regarding milestones and returns on investment. Quintiles has been vague about possible business resulting from the JV, but industry watchers note the deal offers pluses for both parties, in particular for Samsung, which is trying to diversify away from its focus on electronics. Samsung announced in 2010 that it would diversify its business into five areas: solar cells, rechargeable cells for hybrid electric vehicles, LED technology, medical devices, and biopharmaceuticals. In the biopharmaceuticals field, Samsung said it would invest 2.1 trillion Korean won, $1.9 billion U.S., with the expectation of employing 710 people in the unit by 2020 and generating 1.8 trillion won, or $1.6 billion, of revenue. The Samsung Quintiles JV isn't the only recently announced partnership involving an Asian company with scant experience in healthcare. On February 28, Fujifilm announced it was acquiring Merck's biomanufacturing network, including its Diosynth unit in Research Triangle Park, for an undisclosed figure. John Krieger, an analyst with William Blair & Company in Chicago, says both Samsung and Fujifilm might be launching their drug businesses with manufacturing first because they have experience in that area. Quintiles, meanwhile, will benefit from partnering with a company with deep pockets. Samsung is not generally known as a life sciences company, but Quintiles is, Krieger says. A Samsung Quintiles JV doesn't look as risky. They bring a lot of brand appeal, so my bet is Quintiles says, I can plug my brand in this and I can potentially benefit. Shailen Pike, a senior analyst with Cutting Edge Information, notes that Asia, with its knowledge base, is an ideal location for developing biopharmaceuticals and biosimilars. Quintiles, the largest clinical research organization in the world, has been expanding its presence in Asia in recent years. The Samsung JV will open opportunities for Quintiles to eventually partner with other Asian companies, says Anand Thirumaratnam, senior vice president and head of Asian markets for Quintiles. We see the next phase of growth coming from companies in Asia, which are investing in research and thus will have products going into clinical development in the next 3 to 5 years, Thirumaratnam says. Quintiles will expect to share some of the clinical development as well as the consulting work that comes out of any Samsung development going forward, he adds. This is a partnership with a top Korean company. It entrenches our position nicely in Asia as well as in Korea. Quintiles has been operating since 2000 in South Korea, where it has conducted 102 studies at 540 sites and has recruited 6,800 patients for trials. New homes to sprout soon as waitlist grows. That's the headline on our next article, this one written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the dateline of Pittsburgh. As a waiting list of buyers grows, the Galloway Ridge Retirement Community is starting a second phase of construction that will max out the community's 50 acres adjacent to the upscale Farrington Village community. Galloway Ridge will have an additional 67 residential units and 53 healthcare beds once a $34 million construction project is complete in March 2012. The expansion also will result in the need for 75 additional service-related positions to the retirement community staff of 127 full-time and 125 part-time work staff, says Galloway Ridge Executive Director Jason Kronk. Galloway Ridge opened in 2005 with 234 independent living units and a healthcare facility with 38 beds, plus its own Duke Medicine-staffed wellness center and primary care clinic. It is one of 12 continuing care retirement communities, or CCRCs, in the Triangle that offer sales of condo units and a single-family homes to adults age 55 or older, as well as assisted living and memory care facilities for residents who need additional nursing care. The new phase of the construction will include a 49-seat cinema, a third dining room, expanded lounge, library, art studio, and salon, as well as renovation of the Duke Center for Living locker rooms. Cronk says Galloway Ridge was ready to break ground in October 2008 on its expansion project, but that's when the market stopped lending. By waiting 2 years, Galloway Ridge was able to refinance its debt and fund the expansion at an average interest rate of 5.62%, or nearly $100 million in debt financing. Entrance fees at Galloway Ridge ranged from $213,000 to $782,000 in 2010, depending on the size of the unit. Monthly fees ranged from $2,142 to $4,156, according to Triangle Business Journal research. In Raleigh, owners of the 242-unit The Cypress Retirement Community want to build a second phase with another 61 units at its campus on Strickland Road, but Cypress principal Craig Huggins says he has no immediate plans to begin construction. Developers of the proposed $150 million Cardinal at North Hills Retirement Community on Six Forks Road in Raleigh shelved their plans when they couldn't find an adequate number of buyers to meet funding requirements. The Cardinal withdrew its application to the State Department of Insurance in October 2010. Cardinal developers say they are making plans to redesign the project under a different format. Searstone, another CCRC project that's proposed in Cary, could break ground later this year if it can achieve the 70% reservation requirement of the North Carolina Department of Insurance. Searstone Marketing Director Morgan Lampfear says the community has reservations for 108 of the 169 units, or 64%. In the $109 million first phase of construction, we're very close to this goal, she says. Galloway Ridge has kept a steady waiting list of about 100 people at any given time. Our next article, it's written by Chris Basden with the Dateline of Chapel Hill. The headline, even with jobs harder to get, law schools hiking tuition. UNC Chapel Hill Law School's tuition will rise by a whopping 11% to nearly $19,000 annually next school year as it seeks to implement programs designed to improve students' writing and better prepare them for the real world of lawyering. Tuition and fees for in-state students will total $18,982 in 2011 to 2012. That includes campus-based increases of $414 and a law school-specific increase of $1,500. Some of the additional revenue will go to scholarships, but much of it will be used to hire legal writing instructors as part of a curriculum reform effort. The school has decided to replace about a dozen adjunct instructors with five or six full-time faculty. The instructors are being brought in primarily to shore up the school's first-year writing program, although they also will teach upper-level courses. The goal is to address legal industry concerns over the writing skills of graduates. We think it's an excellent change, says UNC Law School Dean Jack Boger, but it's expensive. An adjunct at UNC receives $8,000 per course, while a full-time professor can easily make $70,000 or more, depending on experience and qualifications. UNC also plans to use additional tuition revenue to modify upper-level courses to better simulate law firm settings. The goal is to have students ready to hit the ground running as soon as they start with a firm. UNC won't be the only local law school to implement an increase next year. Tuition at Campbell University's Law School in Raleigh will rise by 5% from $31,800 in the current year to $33,400 next year. Duke University's Law School will impose a 4% increase, taking it to $48,800. Tuition and fees at NC Central's law school currently sit at $9,961 per year. The Durham School traditionally is one of the best values in the country, giving it a competitive advantage over more expensive schools. "We don't hurt for applications," says Dean Raymond Pierce. Pierce has raised tuition $1,000 a year over each of the past 4 years. But he doesn't plan an increase this year, though he points out that students still will be subject to increases imposed by the university. NCCU's law school tuition and fees are estimated to rise to $10,467 next year, a 5% increase. The rising tuition at some local schools comes at a time when graduates are having a tougher time getting jobs. The Great Recession caused clients to fight back against rate increases and, in some cases, demand price rollbacks. That resulted in layoffs and salary cuts at some firms. First-year lawyers at big firms in the Triangle still can make in excess of $100,000 per year, but that's if they can get a job. Pointer Spruill, managing partner Bo Dempster, says firms aren't hiring newly minted attorneys at the same pace as a few years ago. That can be a daunting thought for new graduates who may have paid $100,000 or more to attend law school. "I think hiring has dramatically decreased," says Dempster. "The law students that I have talked to are all concerned about the amount of debt." Boger agrees that it is a tough time to be a law graduate, but says jobs can be had. He says 96% of UNC Law School's class of 2009 was employed within 9 months after graduation, and nearly all of them had gotten some kind of a job in the legal field. Duke Law School graduates are still getting jobs as well, says spokeswoman Melinda Vaughn. "It is not easy. Our students have to be very thoughtful and diligent in their job searches," she writes in an email response to questions. "But when they put in the effort and utilize the many resources our Career Center provides, they are finding great jobs." And our next article in the Triangle Business Journal has the headline, "These companies aim for low profits for good reason." And this article is written by Monica Chen with the Dateline of Durham. And along with it, it has a picture of a man sitting inside of what looks to be his place of business. Looks like there's some wine bottles in the back. The caption reads, "Tom Ferguson wants some benefits of a nonprofit." Companies with a social purpose are starting to register under a new incorporation status, the L3C, a move that not only highlights their charitable objectives, but also opens new sources of funding. Unlike with most nonprofits, L3Cs offer no tax advantage over traditional for-profit concerns. That could come later, but at this point, the Internal Revenue Service has not implemented a tax code for L3Cs. A business must have a charitable or educational purpose to register as an L3C and must operate so that profit maximization is not its primary objective. Political or legislative entities cannot register as L3Cs. That fits the idea that Tom Ferguson, chef and owner of Durham Catering Company and co-owner of the only burger food truck in Durham, has for a new low-cost catering service company he wants to form. The profits from that company would be used to provide healthy school lunches. Nonprofits are making money, nonprofits are asking for money from other people all the time. "I don't want to be in that situation," Ferguson says. "I want to run a corporation that makes money or at least breaks even." Ferguson is in talks with Duke University and Durham Public Schools about his idea. Durham Catering has previous experience in providing more than $4,000 worth of meals to Student U, an organization that connects college students to tutor Durham students. "I think the primary benefit of doing an L3C now is that it's a way to acknowledge a company that has a public good that is not constrained by operating as a nonprofit," says Ferguson's lawyer, Donna Ray Schmura, of Raleigh law firm Sands Anderson. The L3C designation, technically Low Profit Limited Liability Corporation, has been adopted by 7 states, including North Carolina. Currently, there are 13 L3C businesses in North Carolina, 6 of them in the Triangle area. Jubilee 2010, Living Machine Systems, and Contextual Learning in Raleigh. Beauty by Your Design in Cary, Fed by Faith in Chapel Hill, and The Model for Change in Youngsville. Incorporating as an L3C would make it easier for private foundations to make program-related investments, or PRIs, into them. Under federal tax laws, private foundations must distribute 5% of their capital each year for charitable purposes. Foundations usually do so by making grants, but they are also permitted to make PRIs. Currently, PRIs made to for-profit companies have to go through a cumbersome process that requires a private letter ruling from the IRS. L3C proponents hope the tax code will be changed to make the process easier for L3Cs to receive PRIs. The bill for the L3C designation was introduced by then-North Carolina Senator Jim Jackaman, Republican from Burke, who hoped that the L3Cs would help beleaguered furniture and textile companies gather community funds. With a private foundation, because they wouldn't need to get a good return on their investment, it would be a less risk for other individuals and other businesses that would want to invest in it, says David Heinen, Director of Public Policy and Advocacy with the North Carolina Center for Nonprofits. The problem is that the IRS has not written new tax codes that would reduce the transactional expenses associated with PRIs, which means that currently incorporating as an L3C wouldn't be very different from an LLC. Companies have been seeking various ways to recognize their social initiatives. Another designation that's gathering interest is the B Corporation status for benefit corporation. From B Lab, a nonprofit in Pennsylvania that creates certifications for companies trying to achieve social and environmental benefits, the B Corporation status does not bring any tax benefits as it's not recognized by the state of North Carolina. RTI, Progress Energy, snaring millions from federal stimulus. Government reports North Carolina has received $3.35 billion, which has created 24,403 jobs. And all of that is the headline for this next article, written by Amanda Jones Hoyle, with a Dateline of Research, Triangle Park. Nonprofit RTI International and electric utility Progress Energy are on track to receive nearly $500 million in federal stimulus money, making them the largest non-public sector beneficiaries of the program in North Carolina. As of December, a total of $3.35 billion in stimulus money have flowed to projects in North Carolina. The government claims that money aided in the retention or creation of 24,403 jobs since the bill was passed in February 2009. At that rate, each job created or retained cost $137,477 in federal tax money. RTI International, which is based in Research Triangle Park and employs about 2,300 people in the region, so far has been approved for 55 federal grants and contracts from the stimulus program known as the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. RTI's tally is about $235 million in counting. RTI spokesman Patrick Gibbons says the nonprofit research institute has several other grant applications outstanding. Of the money granted, RTI so far has received about $12 million, which the government figures created or retained 76 jobs. That factors out to $157,894 per job. Gibbons says the small number of jobs can be misleading because the nonprofit is required to report on each project status quarterly rather than annually. RTI stimulus projects range from a $58,000 grant to support Columbia University and Boston University in a study about the effects of passive tobacco smoke on adults and children, to a $160 million grant to build a 50-megawatt energy generation system in Tampa, Florida. RTI is headed by Victoria Haynes. RTI-based MCNC claims it will have created 2,500 jobs by the time construction is complete on the 1,600 miles of broadband fiber it is installing across rural parts of North Carolina with stimulus funding. But according to the federal government's Recovery MCNC.gov website, MCNC has so far created just 10 jobs due to contracts and loans distributed from the stimulus package. MCNC President and CEO Joe Fredoso says the low number is misleading because 99% of the work is contracted to vendors, including engineers and construction companies. We have 30 crews working out there now, installing fiber and 6 to 8 people on each crew, he says. MCNC has been awarded grants totaling $89.7 million for the broadband project. The government says Progress Energy so far created 187 jobs, mostly supervisors and project managers, to staff a smart grid program office in Raleigh in the 10 months since the program was implemented. Progress Energy will invest much of the $200 million it will receive from the U.S. Department of Energy's allotment from the federal stimulus package to support energy efficiency projects in its Florida territories. The company will match the federal funding, says Progress Energy's Jeff Brooks, who says North Carolina customers will benefit because work will be done to increase efficiencies across the company's entire footprint. In the Carolinas, we are expanding our investment and accelerating the program's implementation, says Brooks, noting that the company has been working toward a goal of increasing its energy efficiency. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read from the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Census 2010, Wake Raleigh post huge growth. Raleigh and Wake County grew at remarkably rapid rates during the first decade of the 2000s, the U.S. Census Bureau revealed in releasing the first set of county and municipal level data for North Carolina from the 2010 census. Raleigh's population soared 46.3% during the decade to 403,892 as of April 1, 2010, the official date for the 2010 census. Raleigh remains firmly entrenched as the second largest city in North Carolina, trailing only Charlotte. The Queen City grew by 35.2% during the past decade, and its population as of April 1 was 731,424. The city of Durham grew by 22.1% to 228,330. A 43.5% population surge carried Wake County past another major milestone and within striking range of overtaking Mecklenburg as the largest county in the state. The census pegged Wake's population as of April 1 at 900,993. The population in Mecklenburg County, home of Charlotte, stood at 919,628 after growing by 32.2% over the decade. Overture Networks to buy rival Hatteras. Morrisville-based Overture Networks is buying Durham-based Hatteras Networks in a deal that would unite the carrier Ethernet competitors. Overture Networks CEO Jeff Reedy will hold that title with the combined entity, which is to take the Overture name. Hatteras CEO Kevin Sheehan is slated to step into the role of president with the new Overture. Both companies are venture-backed concerns with technology that allows telecommunications providers to offer their customers high-speed services. Wake lands TerraTech headquarters 105 new jobs. Pesticide research company TerraTech said Monday that it is moving its headquarters from Central Florida to a building in Morrisville and bringing 105 jobs to Wake County, according to an announcement from Governor Beverly Perdue's office. TerraTech, based in Melbourne, Florida, develops natural ingredients for pesticides. The company's executive chairman, Alan Reed, says the key reason TerraTech decided to move to the Triangle was to be able to partner with its educational institutions, including NC State University's entomology and veterinary science programs. And we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal, but be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast.